Gentlemen, our first case for argument is Bartley v. Stanley. Mr. Iskowich.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Mr. McDonald, Mr. Young.
I'm sorry. I have an application for admission.
Oh, no problem, Your Honor. Would you like
me to... I missed that. I just saw it.
Back to the table.
And for that, I need Mr. Johnson. Sorry.
This is Mr. Oaken, the subject matter of that... of that motion, and we will grab Mr. Johnson from down the hall and get him over to the telephone. I apologize. We didn't know we had to be here.
Let's just deny the motion.
Well, that would be a little... I'm sorry? Right. We'll get it straightened out.
Thank you.
Yes, sure. Okay. So you're Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Johnson is still ambling down the hallway. He should be here momentarily.
How will we know he's Mr. Johnson?
I can vouch for him, and then he can vouch for me.
Well, I'll think about that.
Okay, Mr. Johnson's walking into the room. I promise you that this is he.
Good afternoon.
Oh, hi. So you're Mr. Johnson. So you want to present your applicant for admission to our bar?
Yes, I would like to move that Barry Michael Oaken be admitted to the Seventh Circuit.
Well, fine, Mr. Oaken. We'll have to have you.
Step over to the clerk.
Yes.
I'm moving closer to the speaker.
Yes. So you should take your oath. So how do you administer that? Can he hear you?
Counsel,
can you hear us?
Barely.
Probably good enough. Okay, he'll read the oath loudly.
Thank you.
Do you solemnly swear that you will demean yourself as an attorney and counselor of this court, uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States?
I so swear.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and Mr. Oaken, we're happy to have you a member of our bar.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be a member.
Well, thank you. Okay, so we'll go back to our previous case. Mr. Iskowich, sorry about that interruption. I just didn't notice.
Good afternoon again, Your Honors, and Mr. McDonald, Mr. Young again. May it please the Court, my name is David Iskowich, and I'm with the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondent. This case is here on the grant of habeas relief by the district court on numerous aspects of counsel's representation at Petitioner Leslie Stanley's state court trial. The district court also found that in addition to meeting the Strickland test, Petitioner had demonstrated actual innocence such that numerous grounds of counsel's representation were amenable to a federal habeas review under the fundamental miscarriage of justice exception to procedurally defaulted claims. The district court's judgment should be reversed. And in my time here this afternoon, I'd like to speak of two of the main witnesses who testified at trial and the district court's disposition of counsel's handling of those witnesses. The first is Duenna Stanley, who testified at trial that Petitioner confessed to her at 10 p.m. on December 22, 1993, approximately 24 hours after he committed the crime. And the second witness was James Dean, an actual eyewitness to the events, who testified that he, along with the victim and Petitioner, drove around in a yellow Lincoln Continental on December 21st or on the cusp of December 22nd, 1993, after which the petitioner and the victim exited the car in an alley in East St. Louis, Illinois, and the petitioner shot the victim, killing him. The district court believed that counsel's handling of witness Duenna Stanley was deficient because he failed to interview or speak to her or adequately review police notes, police records prior to trial. The district court found that had counsel reviewed these notes, he would have observed a discrepancy between her trial testimony and what she said to the police. And that discrepancy is that at trial, she said that the petitioner came to her home on the night of December 22nd, 1993, whereas in the police report, she said that it was either the 21st or 22nd of 1993, around midnight. The district court also found that Duana Stanley's post-conviction recantation was adequate and was her alleged confusion about the dates was confirmable by reason of her post-conviction recantation, in which she tried to say that it's possible that he came to her home, petitioner that is, on the night of December 15th rather than the 22nd. The problem with the district court's resolution of this claim is that the state trial courts already adduced the credibility of Duana Stanley, who significantly did not testify at the federal evidentiary hearing in this case. At the state court level, the trial court, following the hearing of her testimony, denied post-conviction relief at a post-conviction hearing, and the state appellate court found that on the cold record, it was patently obvious that
Counsel,
Duana...
Counsel, why
yes,
should that matter? Since the right involved, which counsel did not protect, is the right to have the jury make the credibility finding and not to have a judge make a credibility finding.
Your Honor, questions of credibility on federal habeas review that are not rebutted by clear and convincing evidence must stand.
No, you're not getting my point. The question I'm asking is, why is this a question for a judge at all, rather than for a jury? Often what the lawyer has to do is make a witness look bad. And the fact that the judge believes that the witness is or is not telling the truth doesn't foreclose what the jury would do. That's the question I'm asking. Why does it matter whether the judge thought that one or another aspect of her current story is true?
Because the aspect that's at issue here, Your Honor, didn't come out until after trial. The factual basis wasn't of record. That is the dispute between the 15th and the 22nd. I hope I'm following, Your Honor. It doesn't look like I am.
See, here's the problem I have, which is similar. This lawyer did so little that it is very difficult to determine how the case would have looked to the jury had he interviewed these people and brought out the contradictions and so on. After all, it's not a very strong case. So when a lawyer does nothing, I mean, if a person is denied representation, then reversal is automatic. And the theory is, because how could you figure out, if you didn't have a lawyer, what a lawyer would have done? Well, this case seems rather close to that. Very difficult to see what the case would have looked like if the lawyer had interviewed these people and would have picked up all sorts of discrepant observations from them, and then try to make them look bad in front of the jury.
Judge, it was petitioner's responsibility following trial to adduce additional facts which would have shown, as you said, what counsel would have and should have given to the jury. He did this by means of a post-conviction evidentiary hearing, a full-blown one, which isn't common in state courts. He even got a full-blown federal evidentiary hearing. Our argument is that notwithstanding these dual opportunities to expand the record and to show exactly what counsel would have done had he performed up to par.
His first evidentiary hearing was 4.5 years after the trial.
That's true, Your Honor. Yes.
4.5 years.
Correct, Your Honor. At which he
took... The second one
It was this
10
year.
10 years or 11 years after, right?
It's this year, Judge, yes.
Let me go back to the,
of course, Your Honor.
The sister. What exactly did the state judge find? Did the judge find that had the sister been properly interviewed and investigated and prepared, she would not, in fact, have testified during the trial that her memory about dates was uncertain? Or was it that when she so testified in the evidentiary hearing, the judge didn't believe her?
The problem, Judge, is that the state post-conviction trial judge only entered about a two-line written order.
Did he distinguish between those two possibilities?
No, he did not, Judge. It's a one-page order. And the appellate court...
You see, if he had said the former, if he had said she would not, in fact, have helped the defendant on the stand, that might be a very important finding. But if instead what he meant is she would indeed have testified the way a defendant, in a way that would be very helpful to defendant. But I wouldn't believe that aspect of her testimony. Then he's just intruding on the jury's province. And if we don't know which of those it was he meant, how do we give any weight to that finding?
The appellate court expanded on it, Your Honor. And the appellate court took a look at the cold record and found that it was obvious that Duana Stanley was not credible.
Well, but look, if it's obvious that the sister is not credible, if the lawyer had made that obvious to the jury, then the jury is much more likely to acquit. Because as the state's attorney said in closing argument, Duana Stanley was the linchpin of his case. And if the lawyer had done something to make her look bad or incredible, defendant gains a lot.
Sure, Your Honor. I agree with you, and the appellate court addressed that.
But that's not a reason to deny relief. That's a reason to grant relief.
The appellate court has never been the findings of credibility at that point in state court.
What do you think the appellate court found concerning
Duana? It found that her testimony didn't shed any light on petitioners or support petitioners' contention that had she testified in such a way, it would have made any difference, because it found that her testimony was completely mixed up and scrambled. She testified.
Yeah, back to Judge Easterbrook's question. If she was completely mixed up, and if that had been the, if she had given completely mixed up testimony, she was the state's witness, wouldn't that hurt the state?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because the jury was also apprised of an eyewitness whose testimony was corroborated by Duana within 24 hours of the crime.
Yes, but the eyewitness not only was high on drugs, but he may have been the murderer himself.
The drug question, Your Honor, was...
Duana was really, I think, that what turns this case from something where one person is blaming another and who knows what the jury believes, to one that looks like it's very strong. Because even the defendant's sister says he confessed. So if you get out the confession aspect, something really has to happen here.
Judge, I think that you're correct. The confession was, of course, in closing argument, a big part of the state's case, as was the eyewitness identification. Our position is that when these two facts are viewed as in their entirety on this record, and with respect to petitioner's failure to adequately challenge those in the course of a state court proceeding and a federal evidentiary hearing, the jury's
challenge what? What are you talking about?
Challenge, I guess, counsel's representation with respect to the handling of these witnesses. Had he spoken to them before trial, what would have come out? With respect to Duana, we have an inconsistency in dates. Both have been resolved by the state courts. With respect to James Dean, that aspect of counsel's representation was never raised until the federal habeas petition. The federal judge found that the petitioner had actually met the high burden for showing actual innocence with respect to counsel's handling of that witness and other witnesses. With respect to that finding on actual innocence, we also believe that that was error, as the evidence adduced at the evidentiary hearing does not come close to meeting the high standards set by the Supreme Court in Schlupp and then more recently in House. James Dean himself testified at the federal evidentiary hearing on cross-examination that his testimony was his dissembled and confused and hard-headed testimony was coming from the angle of wanting to help petitioner, who he believed not was innocent, but who had been in prison long enough for this crime. We also believe that James Dean's testimony is something of a partial recantation, is inherently unreliable for purposes of showing actual innocence, and his recantation and federal testimony, Your Honors, never even exculpated petitioner. The variance between his trial testimony and his federal testimony seized upon by the district court included in federal court that he now didn't see the gun, and now he says that he actually didn't see petitioner shoot the victim. He only heard the shots, and then he ran out of the car. This is all in light of the fact that the only evidence in this record is that petitioner and the victim were the only two in the alley. Petitioner never introduced any further made any factual, I'm running into my rebuttal time, if I might just finish the point, Your Honors. Never made any, reduced any facts showing that there was anyone else in that alley. In light of that, we believe that the district court's finding of actual innocence on this record was improper, and we ask that the court reverse its judgment and remand for consideration of two remaining claims. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Iskowich. Mr. McDonald?
May it please the court, Mr. Iskowich. I'm Ted McDonald, and I'm the attorney for Leslie Stanley in this case. As the court has correctly noted, this case stood and fell actually on James Dean's testimony. James Dean is the one who was there that evening and testified as to what occurred, the who, what, where, why, when of what occurred. He was a convicted felon. He was a crack addict, and he was high that night. That's something that the prosecution knew going in. So in the face of that, what they tried to do was find other evidence to somehow corroborate James Dean and buttress his testimony. That's what they did in the face of it. On the other hand, the attorney, Mr. Allard, representing Mr. Stanley, knew, of course, he was a convicted felon, knew he was a drug addict and high that night, and in the face of that, did nothing. He did nothing. He interviewed no witnesses. He did not go to the crime scene. He called no witnesses. He did nothing. He didn't even understand the file in front of him. He stipulated the things that weren't true. He filed a pretrial motion in limine where he didn't even understand what was going to happen. It was Dawana Stanley's testimony he was trying to keep out, and he misunderstood what that was about. As the court has correctly noted, with respect to Dawana Stanley, for example, it was Dawana Stanley.
Do we know how her name is pronounced, by the way? I noticed the two of you pronouncing it differently.
It's Dawana Stanley. That's what my client has told me. That's
right.
what he said at the hearing.
He must know his own sister's name, so
yes.
It's Dawana.
So it's Dawana Stanley. Okay. Dawana Stanley's testimony, of course, was important because, as they've argued, it was his own flesh and blood. Now, the question was twofold. Was this a confession? It wasn't a confession to this crime. There was an issue about, did he make a statement about having killed somebody at some time? Okay? And the issue was, in this case, was they wanted to make it be the night of this incident. They argue in closing argument that in the middle of the night he came to her. Okay? That's what they argued. At testimony, what she said was, what they said was leading into it, directing your attention to late the 21st, early the 22nd, a common prosecutorial slide into it, of course, leading nonetheless, particularly with a witness who has no idea what date it was. Without objection, she says, well, it wasn't the morning, it was 10 o'clock at night. So she knew the time of day, 10 o'clock at night. She didn't know the date. And in the state court, of course, there is no ruling, as the court notes, except in the Fifth District on appeal, on a dry, cold record, they suggest, well, she's just in the affidavit she signed where she said it was December 15th. It was developed further in the record. Well, I never read the affidavit. Well, was it the 15th? I don't remember the date. So the court in the Fifth District Court of Appeal suggested she doesn't even know the date. That's exactly the point. She did not know the date. And if you look at her written statement, she never knew the date. She never knew when that occurred. That's what should have been brought out. That would have cut the legs out under that statement because she never knew when the statement was made. And they were trying to argue it was the night that he actually murdered somebody. The second piece of Dawana's statement, that if he had gone and talked to her and interviewed her, he would have found out that she testified in her statement that it was a black automatic 10-inch pistol, .22 caliber, the same one Willie Snipes saw, the same one her son Michael Stanley, a 15-year-old boy, saw. In the file, in front of this lawyer, was the statement of Michael Stanley. Had she gone and talked to Michael Stanley, who had no rap sheet, 15-year-old boy, who also testified at the federal hearing Judge Herndon had, he testified, the gun that we all saw Leslie Stanley with was a single-shot, long rifle, .22, not an automatic, and it had the word rifle in English written on the side. They tried to argue that Dawana stating that he had a gun that night, corroborated James Dean, who said, I saw him with a .22 Black automatic German gun. All right? So they suggested that, again, Dean's testimony was corroborated by Dwana's statement about the gun, when in fact, if he had interviewed her, he'd have learned from her that it's the same one Michael Stanley saw, and then he would have gotten to Michael Stanley and would have been able to establish that isn't the gun, couldn't have been the gun. So another key part of their corroboration disappears. It disappears. He didn't do that. The other thing that they go into to try to say that James Dean, our star witness, is telling the truth, and this is clearly a preserved non-defaulted claim, is Robert Brock. Right in front of this attorney, Robert Brock, there was a statement from Robert Brock that said he saw him in a fight that night with James Dean. So James Dean and the decedent Sammy Wilborn were in a fight that very night. Now, the defense attorney on cross-examination, where the court has said, well, there was extensive cross-examination at trial by Mr. Allard of James Dean, that extensive cross-examination was, he asked him, well, was there a fight between the decedent that night and James Dean? So, no, not really. Well, Mr. Dean, were they pushing and shoving? No. Were they shoving? No. Did it have to be broken up? No. Was Robert Brock there? I don't think so. Nobody had to break it up. No. Robert Brock gave a deposition, and we provided that to Judge Herndon in the district court, and of course Robert Brock said there was a fight. There was a fight. It was with bottles. It was with fists. He was knocked down. It had to be broken up. And Robert Brock had to keep somebody there to keep him from fighting again. That statement provided a motive for why James Dean would have been the murderer. That motive was never put before the jury. It may have been put before the jury in one way, and that is when the counsel cross-examined James Dean and got all the no's about Robert Brock being present, about the fight, the seriousness, and all the rest of it, the issue there was the jury could say, well, I guess Robert Brock's coming in to testify. Why else would he ask him those questions? He never brought him in. He never put him on the stand. So the jury could only conclude, well, maybe it didn't happen.
Do we know what counsel did do for the defendant?
Do we know what counsel did do? Yes, we know what counsel did do for the defendant. What counsel did was interview him one time at the courthouse about 2 months before the incident. Mr. Stanley testified at the hearing that he had no other consultation with him except the morning of the trial when he had to sign a stipulation. And his own file, pardon me?
So there's one interview. What else did counsel do?
He did nothing else.
Well, he cross-examined witnesses.
Right. Well, no. I mean, as far as before trial.
Oh, right.
Before
other trial. Than, other than what he
yeah.
did.
Other than the record. Yeah, yes, he cross-examined. He cross-examined right. Mr. Dean in a couple of weeks.
I just was asking right. about preparation.
Yes, and I'm just saying preparation.
Right. And I'm interested in those kinds of things because
yes.
often lawyers don't do much at trial and rest without presenting a defense because they've done a lot of preparation. And there's nothing much to do. But your position, I take it, is that this lawyer couldn't make an intelligent choice about that because he hadn't done the groundwork.
That's exactly right. And when you read his testimony in the deposition we took and in the federal evidentiary hearing, what he said was, he said, well, my technique would be to, I would look at a statement. And if the witness testified consistent with the statement, well, then so be it. They'd testify with the statement. Mm-hmm. Now, if they testified something differently, I, of course, could impeach him with the statement. And, of course, if they recanted, then it's all the better. So there's no reason to ever talk to a witness.
Harry Mason, he is not.
No. And so that's what his approach was. He didn't do any of that. Yet it was all there to be done. There was a timeline. I mean, this case is somewhat unique that there was a federal public defender who walked right through the file, Mr. Lawless, and testified for a long time in front of Judge Herndon, walking about through the file, telling about everything that could have been done. Physical evidence, remarkable that he overlooked that. Physical evidence such that James Dean testified as to how this occurred. He said, we were stopped at 3rd and Cooper. Sammy Wilburn got out of the car to go urinate. Then Leslie Stanley got out of the car, walked up in back of him, and shot him while he was doing that. Okay? In the file are the pictures. The pictures that as the decedent was found, he had four pairs of pants on, all buckled up. He wasn't doing that, which Dean said he did. Incidentally, in the crime scene, there were the shell casings, eight shell casings, all found in a little area all around the decedent on the ground. It's an automatic. Mr. Lawless testified at the evidentiary hearing, an automatic weapon. If you shoot somebody, they start spinning out to the right and behind. And if the person gets shot nine times in the back of the head, they're going down and somebody's continuing to shoot. And those shell casings would have been all over the place. The physical evidence seemed to suggest that it was a staged shooting, that he was dumped at the scene, and the shells were dumped there because the physical evidence didn't support it.
The shooting was real.
The shooting was real, but the location
of the body, man.
The location of the body was staged. And the issue about James Dean saying how it occurred was belied by the very physical evidence at the scene. Again, something else that was available to him, he never explored and never saw. The timeline issue that they argued that the timeline in this case supported James Dean, because they said in closing argument, between 12 and 1, James Dean suggested the killing occurred. And that Tamara Evans said, between 12 and 12:30 is when I heard shots and then I looked out the window. We know that couldn't happen because in front of this attorney was a witness statement in the file from Brian Swigert, which is a non-defaulted claim in which Mr. Swigert testified he was alive at 1 a.m. Lacey Green, a lady who lives right catty-corner to this, had he gone to the scene, he would have seen where her house was, where Tamara Evans' house was. Her statement said she drove right down that road. And when she drove right down the road, she'd have gone right through where that body was. She said in the statement, there was no body there. That's at 1:30 in the morning. Again, that cuts the legs out of Dean's testimony about what time it occurred. It cuts the testimony of Tamara Evans about the timing. It also can cut the testimony as to Dawana Stanley saying, when did he come in? Timeline was critical. They argued it. They made it a point. And again, that was all available to this lawyer. In the face of this case, this is unusual in several respects, but this is very much like Davis versus Lambert, which this court has already ruled on in a very similar case, as Judge Herndon noted, that where the lawyer does nothing, does no investigation, doesn't put on the witnesses, does virtually nothing, this is a violation of Strickland, certainly as to the performance standard, which they have never really asserted. They've argued strictly prejudice. And if the prejudice piece of Strickland is that if the violation undermined the confidence in the outcome, clearly any one of these things would undermine the confidence in the outcome of this trial. And whether it's Robert Brock or the timeline or Dawana Stanley. And Judge Herndon held a long hearing. He carefully went through an analysis that was never done by the state court, and concluded that this was very much like Davis versus Lambert, and that no reasonable jury would have ever convicted this man. And I think that's very clear from the record. And unfortunately, he's been in jail for 12 years. We would ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McDonald. Mr. Iskowich, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Just very briefly, a couple of points. I'm still not sure, having been at the evidentiary hearing, what evidence the petitioner adduced, as is his burden, to show actual innocence. He had an expert testify about what might have happened. Well, the body might have been...
I don't think actual innocence is as strong
just
as...
Skip
okay, Judge.
Innocence and deal with whether the issues that were adequately preserved are themselves enough to raise substantial probability that the outcome might have been different.
Of course, Judge. Robert Brock, non-defaulted claim. The problem with Robert Brock's testimony at the deposition is that he admitted that Dean and the victim fought all the time. They pushed all the time. They swung sticks at each other. They constantly argued and bickered, and they always made up. They cooled off. In fact, the parting remark made by James Dean to the victim was, pardon my language, "Don't let me catch your ass later on." And when asked what that meant, he said, "Oh, that's just, you know, that's just street banter. That's just messing around." had the jury been apprised of the fight.
Well, of course, since street gangs often refer to murder as messing around, it's not clear that that's entirely helpful.
Well, Judge James, I'm sorry, Robert Brock said that it was merely street language. It didn't really mean that there was a continuing threat. And had the jury been apprised of the fight...
Did you have an official street gang language translator present?
No, Judge, but Robert Brock's testimony was that it didn't mean anything. It was 95% of the time it didn't mean anything.
Oh, the other 5%?
That's true, Judge.
95% of the time it's friendly. 5% of the time it means I'll kill you. And this is said. Well,
I don't know if it means I'll kill you, Judge. He never said that it means I'll kill you.
Did he really say 95% of the
time?
Yes,
he did, Judge, at the deposition.
That's extremely damaging. Extremely damaging.
I
thought that was your paraphrase.
No, Judge, it was in the depth. If there are no further questions, I think that I've made my points I'd like to make, and I thank the court for its time this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much. And Mr. McDonald, had we asked you to?
I was appointed by Judge Herndon.
Right. Well, thank you very much for your efforts on behalf. We're very grateful to you for accepting this assignment.